Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 20th of April 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Sunny Afternoon at the Hampstead Theatre. This is almost a jukebox musical, almost a biopic musical about the Kinks. It has music and lyrics by Ray Davies of the Kinks and has been written with his cooperation by Joe Penhall. It is directed by Edward Hall and has it designed by Miriam Buerta. It essentially tells the tale of the Kinks from their formation through to, well, really the recording of Waterloo Sunset, I suppose, in about 68, I think that was. And there's a little coda so they can include Lola, because if you do a Kinks musical, you've got to include Lola, really. Unlike a lot of jukebox musicals, where they're shoehorning the music in to fit an odd story, this takes advantage of Ray Davies's propensity to write extremely personal songs about what's happening to him at the moment. So although you will get the hit songs that don't really fit and have to be fit in somewhere, things like perhaps Dedicated Follower of Fashion or Days, which you have to fit in somewhere, other songs which would probably be album tracks fit situations here absolutely beautifully. I mean, I am a massive fan of the Kinks. I'm not enough of a fan enough of the Kinks, actually, because I don't have all the albums, and I'm probably going to rectify that in the next few months. But I do love all the main hits, and I do love Ray Davies' style of writing. I think he's able to write very beautiful songs. Unfortunately, I don't go to enough musicals, and I can't judge how good a musical this is, because I thought it was pretty good, and very good, actually. It's wonderfully performed, it's wonderfully sung, and practically every person on stage at some point picks up an instrument and plays it, quite well. There are a couple of musicians on stage who sit in the background. There's one at the keyboards and one surreptitiously playing the lead guitar on some of the songs. But apart from that, it is music played by the band. You've got the main quartet of the Kinks, Ray played by John Dalgleish, Dave Davies played by George McGuire, Ned Derrington plays Pete, the bass player, and Adam Sopp plays Mick, the drummer. They work extremely well as a group, and you have a very believable portrayal of the various characters. You completely believe that Dave Davies is the way he is portrayed here, and it's a very, 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 very strange person in many ways. But it tells the story really quite wonderfully, and all this, the very personal feelings that he put into his songs, not necessarily the best known ones, really come out here. And it was just such a good evening, and also the performance of some of the better known songs is really quite remarkable. Days is done as an a cappella version. I mean, normally if you thought about Days in a musical, you'd put two actors either side on the stage in spotlights and they'd sing it at each other as a duet. But this is done as a sort of almost a close harmony a cappella song, and works really beautifully. And the way that they do Waterloo Sunset, they sort of build it from ground up, build it from different kinds of inspirations, is a wonderful, almost a finale to the piece. If I had a criticism, it is that because Ray Davies has been so involved in this, it's perhaps a little bit more gentle. I mean, there are bits of violence in this play, but I did think it was a little bit nice and a little bit forgiving in many places, where perhaps that's not actually how they felt at the time. Phil, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you about that. I think because of his involvement, it's a bit like the Simon Cowell, the X Factor involvement thing. I felt it was perhaps a little bit soft on him, although I don't know enough about Ray Davies. But I think one thing I do know now after seeing is that I think he's probably a genius, because the songs, I had no idea the back catalogue, that some of them were by him. I mean, I knew quite a lot of the numbers, obviously the big, the famous ones like Waterloo Sunset and Sunny Afternoon and Dedicated Follower of Fashion. But there were a lot of others that I thought, well, I didn't know that was by him. My problem I had, the Ray Davies character, has a line just towards the end, and he says, it's not about the words, it's about the atmosphere. And I just think that's the big problem that I had for the show. I know it's a preview, but you couldn't hear the words of the big numbers. You could hear the words where they sang the quieter numbers, or for instance, the a cappella number, which was absolutely stunningly done. In the big ones, the really famous ones, I was really struggling to hear what the lyrics were, because the sound was so loud, and they hadn't turned up the mics enough, particularly on the guy playing Ray's speaker, which just meant that all these, and when I could hear the lines, the lyrics are fantastic, were lost, which I thought was a huge problem with the show.
Gareth, what did you think?
Well, I absolutely adored it. I mean, The Kingster's sort of part of the soundtrack of my life, really. And there's a moment towards the end of the first half where they're playing in Cardiff. And the relationship between Mick and Dave has got a bit out of hand, and one hits the other quite violently. And I was actually at that concert. And when that sort of came on, this kind of wave of nostalgia kind of swept over me. But I think the important thing about this show is it is not a jukebox musical. Absolutely isn't a jukebox musical. It is a biographical musical. And it absolutely isn't. I'm trying to think of the right words now. Basically, it is a biographical musical that just works just so well because Ray Davies's music is a kind of hotted Englishness, and it's like part of living in London, really. And it's just such a terrific show. I'm just getting a bit overexcited about talking about it. You're right in saying that the music kind of fits the scene so perfectly. I mean, when Dead End Street starts, I mean, it's sung by his dad, by Ray and Dave's dad. And he sings it like he's telling you his life story. And Dedicated for a Fashion, as you say, is sort of set when they meet the stylist who creates those incredibly loud suits. And Days is sung at a moment where they look like they're about to break up and they're looking back. Thank you for the days. I mean, it just fits at that point so perfectly well. And Sunday Afternoon itself is during this summer, the World Cup euphoria, that kind of summer of 66. And Waterloo Sunset is created before your very eyes. So, I mean, it's a biographical story that only spans 4 years, that has the music of that period by those people in it, that just fits it like a glove, really. I mean, I just thought it was beautifully done. I agree with Phil. There are a few problems with the sound they have to fix, but it didn't mar the show for me, partly because I probably knew every word anyway. And I thought the performances were outstanding, even the sort of small parts, you know, what you might call the supporting performances, the four managers that they have, or five managers that they have, and the family, the sisters, and the mum and dad. I mean, they're all just so, so well done. And Dave Davis, George McGuire is, you know, he absolutely is this pop star. You know, he's got a bottle in hand most of the time and wears a frock some of the time. And he just is the embodiment of the kind of the pop star who's had fame too young, as indeed Dave Davis did, and did go a bit out of hand, really. I can't praise it highly enough, really. I just thought it was a superb piece of work. I think Joe Pentel has absolutely captured the spirit of it. He says in his programme note that he wants people to come out profoundly moved, euphoric and transported, which sounds like a bit of a tall order, but quite frankly, I came out feeling just like that, really. And I'm conscious that it's, you know, it's my period, my band and everything else. But there were lots of people for whom they were not in that audience who absolutely enjoyed it. And you do have the almost mandatory ending where we're all standing up, singing along and dancing and
yeah, all. But that annoyed me because it was very stage managed as a standing ovation. It's the kind of the Mamma Mia kind of thing where they come into the audience and they actually get people out of their seats to dance with them. So they start standing ovation. At that point, I resolutely sat in my seat because I thought the sound has been so bad. I mean, it was the point where it really was spoiling it. A friend of mine said, fortunately, I know the lyrics to most of the songs, so I can kind of get by. But I mean, I know it's a preview, but I just thought, why can't they get the sound right rather than just drown them out? Because I wanted to hear the songs because I thought when they were good, they were fantastic.
I didn't think on Thursday, it was Friday actually, it was that bad. That was, I think, about the fourth preview. I didn't think it was that bad. I still didn't think it was right. And in particular, Ray's voice was too low.
It was far too low, wasn't it?
But
it was lost.
Not as bad, it seems. I think, I mean, you sound as if you had a much worse experience than I do, really. But anyway, it's Hamster's first musical, and I think it might be Edward Hall's first musical. And I want to go back, really, I think.
I mean, having said that, I think it looks like it's a show that with an eye to a transfer, and I think it will probably get that because, I mean, it's hard to tell whether people were enthusiastic or not because of the way they stage managed the ovation at the end, but people did seem enthusiastic. And also the audience at the Hampstead are that age, they're the right age. as I am. It's
an audience, which actually, because I've got to dislike the Hampstead audience quite a lot, I actually was quite refreshing to find it was not a Hampstead audience. It wasn't the NW audience. It was clearly people there to see a show about the Kinks. And I thought that was rather refreshing. But I mean, that does mean you do have an audience disposed to like something. And I agree with you, there's an extent to which the Ovation is stage managed. But to be quite frank, at that point, I didn't really care. I was just having too much of a good time to care at that point. That was where I was. But, you know, we've been to different performances. I don't know, how much earlier in the run was yours?
Well, it wasn't. I saw it Saturday afternoon.
Oh, okay, so you're after me.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's why I was thinking by then, I don't know when they started previewing, but it's about weeks previewing.
Started Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, I still think by then we should have the sound correct anyway. I mean, I know you have to tweak it, but I thought during the show it would get better, but it didn't. And apart from the numbers which didn't have the heavy backing, for instance, the a cappella number, obviously, which was fantastic. And I do agree with you about the Waterloo Sunset, the intro, which is just one of the greatest intros of all time, but the way it's constructed before you actually hear the intro, it's sort of like an intro to an intro. So by the time the intro came, my spine was tingling. And it could have tingled a lot more, I think, if they'd got it right with the sound, I think. Although I did love, as you say, the Dead End Street. I thought that when I saw that number, which is quite early in the show, I thought, my God, this is going to be really good.
And of course, the great thing about this is that there are a lot of songs that are not hits, which is why it isn't a jukebox musical. Because if you want a jukebox musical, you just take all the hits. I mean, this has got lots of more obscure Ray Davies songs that are selected because they fit the situation, I think. But the band are, like the Beatles, a bit timeless. I remember going to a friend's daughter's 21st birthday party, and she'd sort of invited a few aunties as well as her chums. I remember vividly this young chap her age, you know, dancing and singing the words of Dead End Street, every, you know, absolutely word perfect. And I just sat there and thought, you have no right to know all this. But I think actually they're one of those bands that people do know at different ages. And I think that this will appeal to a broader audience than just people who lived through that period or who like that music. I think we ought to mention Miriam Buerta's set, though, because when I walked into the theatre and saw this kind of incredible bank of loudspeakers on the stage, I just kind of took my breath away. I thought it was a brilliant setting just to have three walls of loudspeakers.
Yeah, I agree. A fantastic set.
And I do like that having the platform that comes out into the audience and then the middle horizontal aisle and the two side aisles enabling them to come into the audience does create an intimacy that you don't often get in musicals. And I wonder whether they would get that if they transferred it. But I suppose I'm being a bit nitpicking now.
The problem I had with the catwalk, actually, was that there are an awful lot of young women walking up and down in extremely short miniskirts, and I was sitting right next to the catwalk, which meant that I actually found myself avoiding looking up when people were on the catwalk, just in case everybody thought I was looking up women's skirts. It was rather embarrassing, really.
I was sitting on the horizontal aisle, so people were passing back and forth in front of me, which actually was quite a good position to be in, I have to say.
I was row G, which has the aisle in front of you. I mean, except you can't stretch your legs out because they're constantly running through it and bringing furniture down it, but it was a great place to sit. So in a way, it's sort of perfect, and that's why I think, you know, if the sound's not good in that position, then they've got to sort it out.
Well, I think for the sound, further back and more central, because I was on the end bit of the door end of row G, so I actually think further back and more central would actually be better for the sound. Well,
I was central, so I was right next to the catwalk. I mean, I'd say I'm astonished. Songs that I didn't know were actually by him were his back catalogue, and of course there's the one that was covered by the Pretenders, wasn't there? And I can't think what it's called now.
Stop All Your Stopping.
Yeah. And I think there was another one, actually.
I'm not sure it was covered by the Pretenders. I think it was actually written for...
Oh, was it written for them? Because wasn't he married to Chrissy Hynde, Ray Davies?
Had a relationship for a couple of years.
And just another sort of nerdy thing to mention is, of course, the girl that plays his wife, his Lithuanian Bradford wife called Raisa, is the sister of Johnny Flynn and is in Johnny Flynn's band, which I thought was interesting. Just throw that one in.
And, of course, Tam Williams is the son of Simon Williams, who plays one of the record company execs.
And he's very good, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you just think, oh, God, you can sing.
I didn't know that early bit. I mean, because the show starts when it's actually Dave's band, the Ravens, backing this posh stockbroker at posh parties.
Yeah.
Which I didn't actually know that little bit of history, because that was effectively before the Kinks were formed, but they were formed out of Dave Davis's band. But I thought it's quite a funny start to have this rock band backing a stockbroker who thinks he's a pop singer at these yeah. parties. And then, of course,
he's played by Dominic, is it Ty pronounced? T-I-G-H-E? And I think he's the partner or husband of Catherine Kingsley.
Yeah, the other thing to say about Dominic Ty is that he's a long-time collaborator with Ed yes. Paul, because he's done a lot of their Propeller stuff.
Well, hasn't Tam Williams done a lot of Propeller stuff as well?
I don't think so, but he was in Chariots of Fire.
There were some other Propeller people in the show. I can't remember who they were now, but when I was reading through the biographies on the tube on the way home, I remember seeing a couple of other people who'd done some Propeller stuff, not quite as much as Dominic Ty, but had done a few bits and pieces of them.
Vince Lee has, who was one of the many managers.
I like that. I didn't know that bit either, that they'd actually sort of... You know, so the posh stockbroker and his mate became the first managers, and they found two other managers, so they ended up with four managers. And I thought that was an interesting piece of history, which I didn't really know about.
We're now going to talk about A View from the Bridge, which is on at the Young Vic. This is Arthur Miller's play about Eddie Carbone, a longshoreman in Brooklyn, supposedly right against the Brooklyn Bridge, in, I think, his Red Bank is where he lives. He looks after his orphaned niece together with his wife and has a possessive love for his niece. I'm not entirely sure that it's ever supposed to be sexual. This is directed by Ivo van Ho, who has taken the apparently very strict stage directions that Arthur Miller wrote for this. And Arthur Miller wanted to place it very particularly in a house in Brooklyn right next to the bridge, and there are very particular things about the set and all the props that are to be used. In this, Ivo van Ho has just given us a thrust stage with Perspex bench seat all the way around, and everybody is barefoot, and I think the only prop ever brought on stage is a chair, and that's it. And the violence inside is very stylized. It's a really quite an impressive piece of work in many ways, and it might not be good for Miller purists, but I think it was... I found deeply impressive. Now, Ivo van Ho works quite a lot with Amsterdam Toneel Group, who have done things like Scenes from a Marriage in London last year, and the Antonioni Project the year before, and I think it was the Roman Tragedies before that. So he's a very, I don't like to say avant-garde director, but he is a somewhat an experimental director, and this certainly shows his experimentation. But he does bring out some very powerful performances from the actors. Playing Eddie Carbone, we've got Mark Strong, who's, I think, back on the stage for the first time in a while. Certainly the last time I saw him on stage was in 2002 at the Donmar Warehouse. He's been making himself famous in an awful lot of other things since then. He's joined by Phoebe Fox as his niece, Nicola Walker as his wife, and we have a narrator character played by Michael Gould. I found this a very impressive piece. I did see it at this play about 5 years ago, when it starred Ken Stott together with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Hayley Atwell and Harry Lloyd as her Sicilian lover. And I think in many ways, although I thought that it was immensely impressive, that particular production, I think I was slightly more impressed by this. I mean, that kind of that simplicity that it has to it, but also it also really brings out the power in the relationship. Gareth, what did you think about this?
I shouldn't really have liked it, because I'm not terribly keen on directors who think they know better than the playwrights, really. You know, sort of mess around with playwrights. And Arthur Miller, as my companion on that evening, who was taught this play in schools, reminded me he was very precise, as you say, on stage directions. In this particular case, there was a very important telephone, a very important record player that were, of course, missing in a propler set. But I actually did like it. So I was kind of surprised in a way that a radical interpretation of the play did actually capture my imagination. And the reason for that, I think, is because it does heighten the drama and heighten the tension quite significantly. And I thought that worked for me. The relationship of Eddie and his niece is more overt in this production, I think. I mean, there's always that kind of hint of sexuality, but actually in this, the way, you know, she jumps up and grabs him and the way he touches her, I mean, and I think we are today more attuned to this kind of thing anyway, really. I mean, I think the relationship is more overt, but I would say it was an obsession rather than necessarily a sexual thing. But it's an obsession that drives the play. I mean, it's an uncontrollable obsession, and it's what brings the tragedy. It's what propels the play, really. I think that Mark Strong is brilliant in this. I mean, he's got an incredible muscularity. The play opens when him and a colleague are washing, they're longshoremen, and they're washing ready to go home. And, you know, the kind of astronaut fills the air. I mean, he's got an incredible physical presence, and I think he is stunning. And it's very hard for me to see a view from a bridge, you know, and because my reference point for the actors is not just Ken Starr, but also Michael Gambon, who did this at the Cottesloe in 1987. But I thought he did make the role his own very much. I really liked Nicola Walker's interpretation of Beatrix. I thought she was a much more tragic kind of Beatrix than you're used to expecting, really. And I think Phoebe Fox was a much more bubbly, effervescent kind of Catherine than you expect. And all of the acting was really great. The set kind of, it feels a bit like a swimming pool in a way, because with the edge, you know, the seat on three sides, you could sort of could fill water and it would be a swimming pool. And it's you don't see it at the outset. It kind of reveals itself very slowly in the scene where they want to go home. There is an incredible coup de théâtre again. There's a brooding soundtrack, which I think is very important to the piece, and at times becomes very religious. The music becomes kind of sacred music, and that kind of brings out the Italian background. You know, this is the New York Italian family, that kind of cultural background, the importance of the clearly defined main roles, the family bonds, the principles of honor, all of that for me came out more in this production than normally done. I mean, I thought it served the play very well, but my companion didn't and thought it was over stylized and indeed, you know, broke the rules that himself set for it. And I kind of wonder how they can do that, really, because, you know, I mean, nobody's allowed to break Beckett's rules, so why should they be allowed to break Miller's rules? I mean, there is an Arthur Miller estate, so I don't know whether they have to get permission from the Miller estate to do that, or whether they just don't have to get permission, or whether they just do it anyway. But it certainly doesn't comply with his original stage instructions and directions, but whether that's allowed or not, I really don't know. But I thought in any event it worked, and I, you know, I don't know Arthur Miller, but I would have thought Miller would have approved of something that still had essence of piece, and indeed heightened the drama and the tension of the piece. I think it was disrespectful to the piece, unlike some directorial interpretations, which we sometimes are. I think it did serve Miller's play. I enjoyed it very much indeed, and I had seen work by Ivar van Hove before, and I had seen Mark Strong for a very long time. I'd like to see him again pretty soon, please, because he is a great actor. So a very rewarding evening for me.
I have to say I'd like to see Mark Strong doing some other Miller heroes. I mean, perhaps, I mean, we're going to get a Crucible later this year, and he would make an exceptionally good John Proctor, and perhaps he could revisit Death as a Salesman. He was in Death as a Salesman in 1996, I think, as the young boy, and perhaps he could, in 5 or so years, it might be good for him to revisit the role of the salesman.
I think he could do that role, and also the All My Sons lead role. I think I've forgotten the character's name now, but I think that both of those roles he could do really, really well. I think he is very much made for Miller, I think. I'd quite like to see him in other American stuff, to be honest. I'd quite like to see him in Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams. I think he's got a style of acting that kind of suits those very dramatic 20th century pieces, really.
About 15 years ago, he was in For Speed the Plough. I thought he was really good in that, and it was transferred from, I think, the New Ambassadors to the Duke of York's, and they completely changed the cast and completely wrecked the play, and everybody complained about it. But the actual one that they did, which was accompanied by Patrick Marber and Kimberly Williams, that was really rather good, but they put in a sort of a more West End friendly cast, I think, when they transferred it, and it completely ruined the play, apparently.
I remember seeing it, but I don't remember whether I saw... I don't honestly remember whether I saw it with him or the other cast. But in any event, subsequent to that, of course, we had, did we not, the Old Vic production with Kevin Spacey and...
I think it was Jeff Goldblum, wasn't it?
Jeff Goldblum and Kevin Spacey, which for me put every other production of Speed the Plough just into the dustbin, really, because that was just electrifying.
We're now going to talk about Privacy at the Donmar Warehouse. This is a new play by James Graham, directed by Josie Rourke, and stars Joshua Maguire, Michelle Terry, Nina Sosonia, Jonathan Coy, Paul Chahidi, and Gunnar Kothari. It's similar to some of the plays that David Hare has done recently, investigating a subject and having a writer at the centre of the piece, sort of trying to put the play together in a way. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it's about privacy in the Edward Snowden sense of the word rather than in the Leveson Inquiry sense of the word. So it takes as its starting point, I think, the sort of revelations of Snowden about snooping and then adds in an awful lot of other stuff. It is somewhere between a verbatim theatre piece and a kind of illustrated lecture. And I think I would prefer to call it sort of staged investigative journalism, really. I mean, it's completely unlike James Graham's last play, which was This House at the National, which was about a period in 70s politics. So it is a completely different thing altogether. And what he's done is clearly a lot of research. He's clearly done an awful lot of research. And he's put himself on stage as, quote, the writer, end quote, who's talking about his research. And we also get the director, who is clearly Josie Rourke. And that also tells us a bit about the development of the piece as well. And you learn a fair bit about how exposed we are in this kind of modern world through the internet, through Wi-Fi and so on. And it is illustrated with a lot of audience participation that I won't talk too much about. You know, it does affect you, even though I knew some of it before. I did kind of leave the theatre a bit shocked, to be honest, as to how exposed I am. And I do think it will make me more cautious, maybe change my ways a bit. I think it works better in the first half, although the first half is a little overlong, than it does in the second half when it becomes more serious. So it's quite kind of playful in the first half, making its points well but doing it playfully, and then it becomes a bit more earnest and a bit more serious in the second half. And I think it's overlong, running at about 2.75 hours, which I think is definitely too long. There's lots and lots of ideas, and it's very creative, but it doesn't have enough structure for me. I think it does kind of need to be put in some sort of structural shape, or better shape might be the best word for it. It needs kind of tightening up a bit, really. I was entertained enough, and I was certainly informed a fair bit, and I don't regret seeing it, but it wasn't... I don't think I saw the finished article, really. I mean, I kind of, one of those occasions where I left the theatre, I don't often go to previews, one of the occasions where I left the theatre thinking, no, I don't go to previews, because you left with real sense that it's going to be a 20 weeks' time. That was how I felt, really. But it certainly affected me, and to an extent entertained me, and I admired it. I would like to see the finished article, although I suspect you're never going to get a ticket now, but there you go.
Yeah, I thought it was well done, like you said, and the play I was trying to think of earlier was, of course, The Power of Yes, which was on at the National Theatre, and where David Hare wrote about his own investigation into what exactly went wrong in the financial crisis. He wrote it in 2009, and it was 2000, so it's a financial crisis 2008. And I was reminded very much of this, although this is kind of a much more personal, sort of an inward place. We have the character of the author in this is investigating himself, and quite a lot of these discussions, especially in the first half, take place with a psychiatrist or an analyst trying to get into his head and get into who he is and what he's like. And you do have this rather strange relationship, as you said, with the director, who is trying to find out an awful lot about him and sort of gets him monitored so she can track him, which is rather amusing. The problem, I think, with some of the audience participation is actually getting people to do things. I mean, some of us are fairly sophisticated and if somebody says log on to this Wi-Fi network, we're very suspicious, because if you log on to a Wi-Fi network, people can they can actually find out your passwords and stuff like that and pretend to be you, and all sorts of nasty things can happen to you if you log on to something. Yep. You're always told that if you're ever in a public place, you see in your Wi-Fi selection box there is a thing that says free Wi-Fi. Never ever click onto it, because it's likely to be somebody trying to, I believe it's called, sniff your packets, as it were. And on the night we went, there was quite a lot of caution from people, and they're going to have to sort of develop that and get people more willing to do it, and encourage people to interact more, because I think that the audience participation, which does play a part in this, although it is, I think you can see the contrivance at some, I can certainly see the contrivance at some points, the audience participation in this was, it wasn't quite as enthusiastic as everybody else, because most people who go, they're fairly enthusiastic. I mean, if it was all sort of teenagers, they might be able to get them to do stupid things on with their phones. But people are somewhat less willing to do that sort of thing in the audience. And it's always a difficulty with audience participation, because you do have to get the outcome that you want, you also want to make people feel that they can participate. And that and I don't think when we went that there were enough people who were willing to participate. Everyone was a little bit nervous and a bit worried about, it was really displaying themselves in front of the audience, because they were told that anything they did wouldn't go beyond the play, but it was rather, I think people were rather worried by that. But all in all, this is I thought it was a very interesting investigation of the whole thing, and also saying that the thing about whether or not the privacy is something that we need to worry about, because this is, I think, a problem quite a lot of people have, although it's made a joke of, you know, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to fear. A lot of people think, well, you know, I really don't care if people know stuff about me. It's only when they turn the glare on you because you have offended in some way that it becomes worrying, because suddenly you find out that people can find an awful lot about information about you. They can find a great deal of stuff about who you are and what you think and what you do, and it is possible then to perhaps control you, or to mess with your life in a major way, which is something that we're not worried enough about, and it's very difficult to actually to get people to be worried about. And that is an issue that's dealt with here.
Well, it is a bit scary, I have to say. I mean, it is a bit scary when you realise, you know, some of the facts it presents you with. You know, that were new to me. I was shocked, I have to say. And I think that will and has brought a degree of caution and a degree of scepticism to me that is probably very healthy, and I think might well stay with me. I mean, you talk about reluctance of people to participate. I did participate probably more than you, and probably regretted it. So that's probably worth saying.
Yeah, certainly. But as I say, most people were very cautious, which, yes, I think is a pity, because you do want people to feel that they can participate, and that would make it, I think it would make it a lot better. It meant that the things that you have to do whenever you do audience participation, you have to know what the likely outcomes, and you have to be able to pick up the likely outcomes. And I thought there were one or two things. There was a good heckle from somebody sitting near me about the play, and they reacted to that very well. But you have to set things up so that people will not only participate, but you will also be able to cope with what they do. And I didn't think that entirely worked, and it's a bit of a pity, because I think it would make it better if they could.
I think it's worth mentioning the performances, which we haven't done. I mean, Joshua Maguire, I think, is really good as the writer, and it's a very difficult role, I think, because he does at times have to improvise a bit. And then all of the other characters, and boy, there are a lot of them, are all played by just five actors, which includes, you know, great actors like Michelle Terry and Nina Sosania and Jonathan Coy. I mean, well, let's mention them all, Anguna Kauthri and Paul Shahidi. I mean, they you know, the five of them really, really do well, without impersonating people, to kind of switch very quickly between all of these characters who are journalists or bankers, or, you know, it can be anything, anyone and anyone, really. And I thought that was very well done. I mean, normally you wouldn't get people of that calibre, I think, doing that kind of role. And I think that probably added something to it, I think.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And also the way they switched was really quite impressive. I mean, sometimes they would simply have to say, oh, yes, I'm actually playing somebody else now. But that worked very well. I was very impressed, especially by Michelle Terry, especially when she was playing the director. It was really quite scary.
Yes. I think they were aided by the back wall of the Donmar is turned into a giant screen. Whenever somebody comes on, they quickly put up the photo and the name and the position of the person. So that kind of does help quite a bit. And some of the stuff on the screen seems to be operated live by a, quote, researcher, end quote, who sort of sits on the edge of the stage with his computer doing things. So, I mean, there was a lot to enjoy about it. But as I said, I didn't feel it was the finished article, really.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook. On the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.